Good morning. As you filter in, I think we'll get started. This morning, we have a new speaker, never spoke here before, and Dr. Mark Richards. Welcome back, Dr. Richards. Dr. Richards needs no introduction, but I'll still introduce him. Dr. Richards did his undergraduate work at Northwestern University, did his medical school at University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, internal medicine at University of North Carolina Hospitals, and his renal fellowship at the University of North Carolina Hospitals, UNC Kidney Center. Obviously, he's very much involved in the teaching program with medical students and the residents here at the hospital, and of course, he's in private practice in South Florida, kidney disease and hypertensive specialist. This morning, his topic is achieving equilibrium in end-stage renal disease patients. Please join me in welcoming back Dr. Richards.
Hey, good morning, everybody. All right, so let's talk about dialysis. This is great. I'll do to start is I'll just sort of introduce the dialysis prescription and all the things that we can kind of control when patients are on dialysis. And specifically, we'll dig a little deeper into a few things. Adequacy, like how do we know if our patients are getting appropriate clearance of solutes? We'll talk about dry weight and ultrafiltration, volume issues in our dialysis patients. We'll also talk about how we, you know, keep electrolytes, acid-base balance in tune. And then at the end, we'll dig a little bit into management of anemia in our patients and also bone mineral disease. So here's the dialysis prescription. So it all starts with a good access. We hope our patients have AV fistulas, and we'll talk about some of the benefits of that in a little bit. But also patients can have arteriovenous grafts or a central venous catheter. The first things we set are the time. We provide a prescription, and hopefully it's long enough for appropriate removal of solutes and fluids. Patients always like the time to be less. We like the time to be more for a number of reasons, not just because we're evil. And at the same time, we also can set the dialyzer. And the dialyzers have a number of different components that we look into. First, we want to make sure it's appropriately sized to ensure good clearance. At the same time, the pore sizes inside where solutes can move across or diffuse or ultrafiltration can happen. And that can affect clearance of not only small solutes, but also middle molecules like beta 2 microglobulin as well. And then we can also set what's called the blood flow rate in milliliters a minute, how quickly blood flows out of the patient through the dialyzer to be cleaned. We can also set what's called the dialysate flow rate, as you can see, there's a semi-permeable membrane with those pores that I just mentioned before. And there's a countercurrent flow, which can aid the both diffusion and ultrafiltration. And then in the dialysate itself, we can select the composition of the fluid. We can talk about how much sodium is in there, how much potassium is in there, how much bicarbonate we put in there, which is largely replaced acetate as the means of alkalinizing our patients, and also dialysate calcium. And then also we can set ultrafiltration. We can set, you know, often it's based on something called an estimated dry weight or EDW. We'll talk about how difficult that is to figure out in a little bit. And usually based on that, we can set ultrafiltration goals, how much fluid you want to remove from the patient in the given amount of time. And finally, there's a number of drugs that we provide our patients, whether to correct both anemia of end-stage renal disease as well as kidney disease-associated mineral bone disease. And we'll talk about that more towards the end of the talk, whether it's IV iron, erythropoietin stimulating agents, or activated vitamin D products. So in terms of adequacy, what are the things that we're trying to get rid of in dialysis? So the first thing everyone thinks of is the BUN. It's small, it's water soluble, it's easy to measure, it's on every basic blood test. But interestingly, and even though this is the main marker of assessing dialysis adequacy, it might not be the actual cause of a lot of problems. We don't really have good ways of measuring these other proteins, but certain small protein or certain small protein bound solutes like indoles and phenols are thought to potentially be contributing to uremia more than the BUN itself. But the BUN just happens to be an easily measurable surrogate for that. At the same time, higher flux or larger pore dialyzers are more effective at removing middle molecules like beta 2 microglobulin. And also something to note, you know, when we're assessing our patients, obviously we want our patients to have adequate dialysis or appropriate solute clearance, but it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as someone who's doing well on dialysis. Someone could have, having failure to thrive and be, having a loss of functional status despite us, patting ourselves on the back that they have an appropriate clearance. So the BUN, so again, it's easily measurable. It's a good surrogate and marker for, the buildup and removal of nitrogenous wastes that often are associated with protein intake or protein catabolism. But again, there's studies suggest that those other solutes like indoles and phenols, things that are really, really hard to measure, may actually be more important. And at the same time, BUN can be, it can be high, unexpectedly higher or lower due to different clinical states. If someone is on high doses of steroids, for instance, the BUN may be higher. If someone is cachectic or having failure to thrive, the BUN may be lower, and that may affect how we measure how well a patient is doing with the dialysis treatment. So the quickest and easiest way to measure how well we're cleaning someone's blood during a dialysis treatment is something called the urea reduction ratio. And basically, you take the BUN before the treatment, you subtract the BUN after the treatment, and you divide it by the pre-dialysis BUN, and then you multiply it by 100 to get a percentage. Ideally, we like to be, we want to remove about two-thirds of the BUN during the treatment. But again, this doesn't take into account the development of urea. It doesn't take into account ultrafiltration, which can sometimes, artificially inflate this number a little bit. And at the same time, these calculations are based on when we measure the post-dialysis BUN, because there tends to be a rebound of BUN right after the treatment. As we pull it out of the vascular space, there's a kind of a net efflux over time of the BUN out of the interstitial space back into the plasma, if based on when you check that number after the treatment, you can affect the calculation. So over time, another marker was developed called a KT over V. Has anyone ever heard of that before? No? Okay. Well, we'll learn together. So this is sort of a more advanced way to measure fractional urea clearance. And I sort of simplified it so we can go over a sample case. So basically what it means is it's sort of the product of how well the dialyzer clears urea. And that's something that's included with the dialyzer. On average, you get about 200 milliliters a minute of urea clearance. And then you can multiply that by the time on dialysis in minutes. And it's divided by V, which is the volume of distribution, which is sort of a surrogate for total body water. And so basically what you're saying is how much urea are you clearing over a certain time from a certain space. And so careful, there's gory mathematical details ahead. And so let's say you have your 70-kilogram man dialysis patient, and they're on dialysis for 4 hours, and your dialyzer urea clearance is about 215 milliliters a minute. If you do some math, you can take the dialyzer clearance and multiply it by the 240 minutes of how long their dialysis treatment is, and then if you divide it by their total body water, which if you remember is in the average person, although this varies, it's about 60% of your weight. So if you do 70,000 times 0.6, you get a number of about 1.23. And so there's been studies out there, a number of studies that have been done that have showed that KT over V is greater than 1 to 1.2 are associated with increased survival and less complications. And so that's basically become the benchmark for what we aim for in our dialysis patients. And this is a number we check in the dialysis unit once a month. And so here's a chart showing, or a graph showing, the correlation between the urea reduction ratio and the KT over V. And for the most part, there's sort of a correlation. So again, we'd like the urea reduction ratio to be more than 65%, and we like the KT over V to be greater than 1.2. And for the most part, they're sort of in sync with each other. But interestingly, the amount of ultrafiltration we perform, if we're more aggressive, that can actually lead to a artificial increase in that number, which can possibly give you a false sense of security. So again, there's a number of limitations to this. In a nutshell, this can be artificially elevated by ultrafiltration or an increased K/KT, but especially a diminished V. You know, so if patients are smaller, they will obviously have a lower V, and that can lead to a artificially increased number if your denominator is less. At the same time, this is making an assumption that the removal of your BUN is similar to the removal of other uremic toxins and middle molecules, and other studies have shown that's not necessarily the case. Also, like I mentioned before, there's the issue with the rebounding of urea that can happen, you know, in the 30 minutes to, you know, 1 hour after the dialysis treatment. So the thinking was that, all right, we've shown that, you know, getting a KT over V of 1.2 is pretty good. What happens if we go for even higher numbers and shoot for the stars? You would think that more clearance would be better, and patients would do better. So there was a huge trial that was done called the HEMO trial that was in the New England Journal in 2002, and they took patients over about 5 months of follow-up, and they aimed for either a standard dose, clearance or a very high dose clearance. Obviously, a 1.7 is very, very good, and it turns out that over the full follow-up, there was essentially no difference in mortality in these patients, and there really wasn't much of a difference in a lot of secondary markers as well, hospitalizations. I think there was no difference in non-cardiac MI as well. The study did actually show a slight benefit in using higher flux dialyzers, which again, not only are good at clearing small solutes, but also like larger middle molecules like beta 2 microglobulin as well. And it was for that reason that we often will use, you know, larger pore or higher flux dialyzers in our clinic. But again, and this has been confirmed on multiple kind of subsequent studies, that, you know, pushing for much higher clearance doesn't necessarily improve outcomes. It's okay. And also, I know. Interestingly, like, do you know how much clearance dialysis provides? Like what, you know, what kind of kidney function it is equivalent to? Because obviously, if you look at a dialysis patient's labs, they're not normal. It's actually only about 15-20%. So ultimately, you know, we're providing just enough kidney function in those 12 out of the 168 hours a week to prevent a patient from becoming uremic. But interestingly, you know, again, pushing for more clearance doesn't necessarily improve anything. So this is a question I get in the dialysis unit a lot, is what happens if that KT over V is low and we're not adequately clearing our patients? Oftentimes, the most important thing you can do is increase the time of the treatment. And it's often patients, you know, they're not thrilled to be at dialysis. And, you know, they want to get on with their lives and do the things they want to do. And so obviously, if you're trying to increase someone's time, there's going to be a lot of resistance to that. But that's just the easiest way to ensure adequate clearance. At the same time, we can use a bigger dialyzer with higher levels of urea clearance. Those often tend to be higher flux membranes. Also, we can increase the blood flow rate. And this is really important in patients regarding their permanent access. Patients who have fistulas or grafts tend to have, you can achieve much higher blood flow rates, sometimes even 20-30% higher blood flow rates than you would in a patient with a catheter. Whereas in a catheter, you might top out at 300 to 350 milliliters a minute. In a good fistula, like one that Dr. Lee would place, it can get up to about 500 milliliters a minute. At the same time, our dialysis nurses can use larger gauge needles, and that also can help improve circulation. There can be issues with the permanent access. If you have a catheter, sometimes you can get a fibrin sheath. In fistulas, you can have inflow or outflow stenoses, which can lead to recirculation, which basically means then you're dialyzing a small part of the body really, really well, but you're not dialyzing, you know, the whole body very well. And oftentimes those patients will need some sort of vascular access procedure. And then finally, any attempt to preserve residual renal function is helpful. Any pee the patient can make, even if their kidneys are working at 2 to 3%, that's still more than nothing, and that can actually help you achieve adequacy. This becomes more important in our peritoneal dialysis patients. So next I'll move on into fluid and volume balance. So the key here is this is one of our like industrial dialysis looking scales in the floor. All of our patients get weighed when they walk in, and our patients get weighed when they walk out. And so when they're on the machine, the change in the weight is based on parameters that we set. Basically, we set an ultrafiltration usually to target a patient's dry weight, and I'll talk about that in a second. And so if we set a patient to have 3 liters removed of that treatment, theoretically they should walk out 3 kilograms lighter. And then at the same time, when the patient leaves and then comes back, the patients will often gain weight. They're eating salt, they're drinking, and they're not peeing very much. And so whatever they consume stays on as weight, and usually it's volume-based. And so the term that we have for that is called what's called IDWG, or intradialytic weight gain. And this is a huge, you know, a huge area where, like, you know, we're trying to improve like the quality of life for our patients. So the reason for that is that high intradialytic weight gain is bad. You know, generally a low benchmark that we want for our patients is no more than 5% of their total body weight between the treatments, but really we should aim for even less than that. The reason for that is that if you gain more weight, we're going to be compelled to pull it off at the treatment. And if we're trying to pull off too much fluid too quickly, we can cause a lot of problems. And so this is a study that was done about 5 years ago, but they looked at patients and they figured out how much, like how fast were we pulling fluid off of our patients. And it turns out that once the ultrafiltration rate got above 10 milliliters per hour per kilogram, both not only all-cause mortality and cardiovascular mortality significantly increased. And so it was really because of these trials that a lot of the major dialysis organizations have, you know, almost like put a limit on how fast we can pull our fluid off. And so they set a benchmark of about 13 milliliters per hour per kilogram. So if you think about that, if a 100-kilogram person gains 5, you know, kilograms in between their treatments, and they have a 4-hour dialysis treatment, if we want to pull off those 5, you know, those 5 kilograms in 4 hours, it ends up being about like 12.5 milliliters per kilogram per hour, which is, you know, barely a goal. So for someone like that, they might benefit from a longer time on the machine to avoid pulling fluid off at too fast a rate. At the same time, if we're over-aggressive with our clearance, this can be bad too. And so this is especially true in patients who are starting dialysis and they're, you know, they're really, really uremic and have a very high BUN at the start of their treatments. If you start here, patients in their extracellular fluid have a very high serum osmolality of about 320 milliosms. And that's, you know, they might have a normal or slightly diminished serum sodium and a very high BUN, and a lot of our patients are diabetic and may have a high glucose. And then at the same time, not only can we we can ultrafiltrate based on the hydrostatic forces across the dialyzer, but the dialysate osmolality is about 280. And so if you think about it, as urea moves out, the osmolality of the extracellular fluid is going to fall as we pull out that solute. And this becomes relatively dilute. At the same time, then in the intracellular fluid, this is still 320, and because of that, you're going to have water movement. Because you're more concentrated in your cells, water is going to move in by osmosis to try to regulate that. And so, if we're trying to pull a lot of fluid, and then at the same time, water is kind of going the other way back in the cells, especially if we're going really fast with our ultrafiltration rate, this can cause a lot of problems in our patients. And so what kind of problems can we cause? Especially if we're pulling off too much fluid, patients can pass out, they can get lightheaded, they can have muscle cramps. A lot of our patients have vasculopaths, and so they can get coronary ischemia, mesenteric ischemia, They can hypotension, or really any sign of generalized organ hypoperfusion. Something to think about, though, is remember not all patients who have these symptoms are dry. Volume overloaded patients can have this too, if we're pulling fluid off too quickly, especially like, as I just said, in the setting of vascular problems. If we're not as aggressive pulling fluid off, patients can be volume overloaded. They can get hypertensive. They can get edematous, and they can be more prone to left ventricular hypertrophy, congestive heart failure, and other terrible, terrible things. If there's one thing that the most common thing that takes out our dialysis patients is cardiovascular disease, and so we have to be really careful not to leave our patients too overloaded. So the estimated dry weight is a mystery wrapped in a conundrum, wrapped in an enigma. It's the weight a patient should be at the end of dialysis, where they're not having any of these symptoms and they have normal blood pressure and no signs of volume overload. But it's really, really difficult to measure. Basically, at this point, what we have is trial and error, where we keep trying to pull fluid off of a patient until they get these symptoms, and then we're like, oh, we went too far. Let's back up a little bit. Obviously, that's not ideal. But fortunately, there are multiple alternative techniques being developed, some of which I've worked with, some of which I have not seen, but evidence is promising. So the first thing is something called a crit line. This is something I saw in my fellowship, but we haven't used it here. Basically, you attach a cuvette to the dialyzer, and you can estimate a patient's hematocrit. And it's constantly measuring that hematocrit. So theoretically, as you're ultrafiltrating a patient, the hematocrit should go up as you decrease the blood volume. And obviously, you're not ultrafiltrating red blood cells. And so you can actually measure the slope of how the hematocrit changes. And if you're increasing hematocrit by a rate of more than 5%, perhaps it suggests that you're over ultrafiltrating the patient. And if the curve is staying pretty flat, and you're pulling fluid off, and it suggests that the hematocrit's staying the same, it likely represents a volume overloaded state, and you might have some liberty to go for a little bit more fluid. The next thing that's promising is bioimpedance. And so what this involves is basically hooking up these probes to the patient, and you can actually send currents through the patient and measure resistance. And usually, the more resistance you have, it's a surrogate for how much total body water is on the patient. And so the hope is by measuring this, you can get a better sense of fluid status and can potentially help find a patient's dry weight a little bit better. Again, I've never seen this in the real world, but there are a lot of, if you look through PubMed, there's a lot of interesting studies on this. So this is one I pulled out from the American Journal of Kidney Diseases in 2014. It turns out there was a pretty good improvement in mortality with using bioimpedance versus our best judgment, and the patients in the bioimpedance group required less blood pressure medications. And so if you look at these markers of fluid overload between baseline and the end of the study, patients really had no improvement in their volume status with our clinical judgment, but with the bioimpedance, there was a statistically significant improvement there. So this is something that, stay tuned. And then some other methods, you can measure plasma ANP levels. The thought is that these have been shown to be more elevated in patients who are more overloaded or hypertensive before the dialysis session. And if the blood pressure was fluid sensitive, the number dropped down. But they tried to see if they can find a certain number that could correlate with the dry weight, and the studies I looked at, they were unsuccessful. And also, there's also talk of using ultrasonography to measure IVC diameter, but that's still something that people are working on. So then we'll kind of move over into dialysis clearance. So there's two ways that we get there's two ways that we clean people's blood. The most common one is diffusion. Basically, things move from areas of higher concentration to areas of lower concentration. And so when we pick our dialysate, there's obviously, we set it so where there's less bad things in the dialysate than there is in the blood, and there's more good things in the dialysate than there is in the blood. And so remember, the flow is it's bidirectional, so things can move across the semi-permeable membrane in either direction. So again, if you have, this is sort of a very simple schematic of a dialyzer. You have blood flowing this way, and you have dialysate flowing that way. And because things are going in opposite directions, you maintain that gradient so you can achieve better clearance of these molecules. At the same time, there's also what's called convection taking place. This is really effective for removal of middle molecules, and it relates more to ultrafiltration. So as you're pulling fluid out of the blood into the dialysate, you almost create what's called a solvent drag, which can be really effective at sucking these larger middle molecules across the membrane and out into the dialysate. That's best used for things like beta-2 microglobulin, which interestingly we don't really measure in our dialysis patients, but potentially it could be something to be studied later on. So in the dialysate, there's four main electrolytes that we look at. Sodium, potassium, bicarbonate, and calcium. And there's always a range for how we can set this. And I'll kind of go through each one here step by step. So the first thing is dialysate sodium. So everyone's first thought, including mine, is let's just set it 140. It makes sense, right? That's our perfect sodium. And then we can maintain a perfect gradient. The patient remains normonatremic and everyone's happy. But if you, there was a study that was done a few years ago out of NDT, nephrology, dialysis, and transplantation, and they looked at patients' serum sodium levels at the start of dialysis. And it turns out only about maybe 15 to 20% had a sodium level of 140 or above. The rest of patients were actually mildly hyponatremic. And the reason for that is probably just has to do with fluid intake. Remember, in dialysis patients can't really get SIDH because there's no real kidney for the vasopressin to work on. So this relates to fluid intake and relative overhydration and volume overload. So whenever I see hyponatremia in a dialysis patient, that's what I'm thinking about. But they're coming in relatively hyponatremic. And then what they also did was they measured a sodium gradient. They basically took the dialysate sodium that we prescribed for the patient and they subtracted the patient's serum sodium. And it turns out a majority of patients, there was a deficit of about 2 to even up to like 10 milliequivalents per liter of sodium. And when they broke down how people did based on that sodium gradient, it turns out that the higher salts gradients led to increased intradialytic weight gains. And so the theory behind that is if you give a patient a relatively hypernatremic dialysate, you're essentially salt loading a patient. And they may have a set point now that's in the mid to upper 130s. And by salt loading a patient, you're going to have a net, I guess, influx of sodium, and patients are going to become thirsty from that. Remember, salt makes you thirsty. These pretzels are making me thirsty. And so if you get thirsty, you're going to drink more, and then you're subsequently going to get volume overloaded, more hypertensive, and that can lead to all the problems that we see in our dialysis patients, LVH, edema, congestion, and the like. So, you know, for this reason, there's been sort of a trend towards actually adopting slightly lower dialysis sodiums. I think we use a 139 routinely in our clinic or 138. But this is something that we need to, you know, keep an eye on going forward, because this has been sort of a relatively recent advance in how we prescribe our dialysate sodiums. Dialysate potassiums, obviously, the big word we have in our dialysis patients is hyperkalemia. And so we dialyze patients often with a 2-potassium or a 3-potassium bath. And in very emergent situations, you can use a 0-potassium bath. But you won't see it here because we don't have the 0K bath available. And it's a tricky thing to navigate, because when the patients are on it, you have to check. We would check blood, gas, potassiums every 30 minutes until the potassium was compatible with life again, and then we resume a normal potassium bath. Anecdote time: the craziest case I saw in my fellowship was a lady who came in with acute renal failure and a potassium of 8, and was bradycardic at 30. We got her on dialysis with a 0-potassium bath, and literally every like 30 seconds, her heartbeat increased by like 1 beat a minute. like over the first like 30 or 40 minutes until her pulse normalized. It was one of the more bizarre things I'd ever seen. But anyways, so potassium, obviously, just like any other solute that we're trying to get rid of in dialysis, patients will generally come in relatively hyperkalemic. We'll pull it all out. The initial efflux of potassium is highest, like in the first hour of the treatment, and then it sort of slows down. And then after the treatment, just like there's a rebound of urea, there can be a rebound of potassium as well that obviously accumulates over the interdialytic period. And so the things we really worry about with potassium are, you know, we don't want our patients coming in hyperkalemic, but we also don't want our patients leaving hypokalemic. And so this may or may not be related, but there was a study done out of Kidney International about 10 years ago, and they looked at patients and they tried to figure out like when were they most likely to die of sudden cardiac death. And it turns out if time zero is the patient showing up for their treatment, it turns out the highest risk is within when they're on the machine or in like the few hours after they're off the machine. And then over the long weekend, you know, that Friday to Monday or Saturday to Tuesday break, the mortality ratio was highest in the 12 hours prior to that, you know, that treatment after the long weekend. And so there's the thinking that this author had was that perhaps, you know, pre-dialysis hyperkalemia or post-dialysis hypokalemia played a very significant role, in this sudden cardiac death, because obviously both are very bad. And so this is a reason why, you know, when we measure our labs, we always tend to measure them pre-dialysis. But, you know, especially in a number of our patients, we're starting to measure post-dialysis potassiums as well to make sure we're not overshooting and causing the problems that can be associated with hypokalemia. Obviously we want to mitigate acidosis as well. So we place bicarbonate in the dialysis, usually at a much higher concentration that's in the blood. Usually patients are mildly acidotic at the start of the treatment. They come in with bicarbonate levels 20 to 22, and usually we run it somewhere in the mid-30s. And then finally with dialysate calcium, usually we run this between 2 and 3 milliequivalents a liter. That equilibrates out to when you're looking at a blood test, that usually, you know, it's about 4 milliequivalents per liter is the same as 1 milligram per deciliter. So 2 to 3 would correlate somewhere between, you know, 8 and 12. And so generally we run it kind of right in the middle at 2.5. In the old days, patients actually were run on much higher calcium concentration baths. But that's actually gone out. And the reason for that is that low calcium baths have been associated with an increased risk of hypotension, thought basically to occur in the setting of cardiac instability or contractility. But recently, you know, and as we'll talk about at the end of the talk, there's been an increase in the use of calcium-based phosphate binders, activated vitamin D supplements, things that can raise serum calcium levels. And so now with high calcium baths, it's worrisome because we're actually calcium loading these patients. And as you know, dialysis patients have vascular problems. They're prone to increased calcification of blood vessels, coronary vessels, et cetera. And so by increasing calcium loads, you can actually increase something called the calcium phosphate product, where you take a patient's calcium and phosphorus and multiply it by each other. And studies have shown that if you make that number too high, like greater than say 55, you're going to significantly increase the risk for horrible things. Patients might benefit from high calcium, you know, maybe if a patient is symptomatically hypocalcemic from acute kidney injury or rhabdomyolysis, or if a patient has had a parathyroidectomy, and they oftentimes a high calcium bath might be helpful in the short run. So then we'll go into anemia of end-stage renal disease. As you know, kidneys make 90% of our circulating EPO. And as kidney disease advances, we make less of it. And so if we have less EPO, this can lead to apoptosis of erythroid cell progenitors, and subsequently patients can get anemic. The prevalence increases to, I think, the point like 80 to 90% of dialysis patients have some type of anemia that will require treatment. A lot of dialysis patients are prone to iron deficiency as well. So the manifestations are things that you would expect. But what's tricky is that a lot of these are very similar to uremic symptoms of uremia. And so sometimes it can be difficult to differentiate, especially in someone new to dialysis, whether they're symptomatic from their anemia or symptomatic from buildup of uremia. Fatigue, not thinking well, decreased libido, unable to exercise due to dyspnea and exertion. There's also been studies that have shown increased cardiovascular risk in patients who are anemic. Iron deficiency is very common in our dialysis patients. The thinking is, there might be decreased GI absorption of this. Patients might be, a lot of dialysis patients might be prone to occult GI bleeding. Our patients are being phlebotomized a lot. They're getting labs sent off every month. At the same time, if patients are on erythropoietin stimulating agents, those are going to suck up all the iron to get the blood counts up, and that may exhaust iron stores. It's one of the reasons why the epogens and the darbepoietins of the world aren't really helpful unless you're iron replete. In our clinic, we generally, if a patient has an iron saturation or a transferrin saturation of under 20%, that will be an indication to treat, usually with intravenous iron loads. Usually we'll give, we'll give a gram total over, 8 to 10 treatments, and then we'll repeat levels and we'll check. And then oftentimes patients will be placed on a maintenance protocol, like one IV iron dosing a week. Hemoglobins can be variable here. Obviously, if it's too high, we won't give it. And usually these are given in conjunction with ESAs. So the most common ones that you're familiar with are epogen or procrit and darbepoietin or aranesp. These can be given either subcutaneously, as we often will do in the hospital. In the dialysis clinics, though, we prefer to give them by intravenously. It's obviously much more, it's more palatable for the patient. They're already getting stuck enough. So this will help with that. And we aim for goal hemoglobin somewhere between 10 and 11. In our patients, it's been shown to improve morbidity and mortality. Patients have improved quality of life, exercise tolerance, and then especially in our younger patients who are trying to get kidney transplants, this is important because it can decrease the need for transfusions, which can make your blood more sensitized and make it harder to find an organ. So back in the heyday of dialysis, the thought was we should give this to everybody, and we should aim for normal hemoglobin levels, just like what we have. And this was done very routinely. Actually, a huge source of dialysis revenue up until the 90s, even into the early part of the 2000s, was erythropoietin stimulating agents being used on our patients to achieve very elevated or normal hemoglobins. However, a trial came along called the CHOIR trial in 2006 that studied about 1,400 chronic kidney disease, actually not dialysis patients. And they aimed for hemoglobin somewhere around 11 versus 13 to 14. And then it might be hard to see, but it turns out that, the average hemoglobin in the high group was about 13 to 13.5, and in the low group it stayed at about 11 to 11.5. And then this represents the amount of epogen patients got. And patients got about twice as much erythropoietin stimulating agent in the high hemoglobin group versus the low hemoglobin group. And it turned out that when they looked at a composite endpoint of death, myocardial infarction, heart failure, or stroke, there was a significant increase in complications in the high hemoglobin group versus the low hemoglobin group, and it was based on this trial. And what's interesting is right at the time this trial came out, I think it was the National Kidney Foundation released guidelines recommending the high hemoglobin group, and then as soon as this came out, there were all these editorials came out that they probably shouldn't have recommended that. And since then, we've cut back on our goal hemoglobin quite significantly to the 10 to 11 range. In dialysis patients, there's been a couple of small trials, because remember the CHOIR trial didn't apply to hemodialysis patients. There was a trial, the normal hematocrit trial, and actually it was in the late 90s, and these were patients who were on hemodialysis with cardiac disease, whether it was heart failure or coronary artery disease, and they took patients and they aimed for a normal hemoglobin of around 14 or a very conservative hemoglobin of 10. And it turns out there was a statistically significant increase in the probability of death or myocardial infarction in the higher hemoglobin group. And they actually stopped this trial early. So it's pretty amazing that we had this data on the books for quite a while before the dialysis, you know, organizations came around to recommending more conservative hemoglobin targets. Obviously, there's many adverse effects. What could have potentially resulted in these problems? Studies have shown when aiming for normal hemoglobins, you can have increased mortality, cardiovascular events. There's an increased risk of malignancy as well. And also in that trial I just showed you, there was about a 30 to 40% increase in the risk of permanent venous access thrombosis in these patients. Some more work for Dr. Mata and Dr. Lee if we aim for higher hemoglobin targets. And really, when aiming for any hemoglobin, we often will watch out for hypertension. A lot of our chronic kidney disease patients often will get turned away from the hematology office if they show up and their blood pressures are too high. And the worry there is that EPO potentially has some vasoconstrictive effects. There actually are EPO receptors in a number of our smooth muscle and in our blood vessels. And through vasoconstriction, endothelin agonism, increase in renin and aldosterone axis synthesis, these things can all lead to increased blood pressure. So finally, this is extremely complicated, and I'm going to break it down into like a few minutes, so hopefully I don't overwhelm you. I'll talk a little bit about how we maintain order in chronic kidney disease or end-stage renal disease-associated mineral bone disease. So there's a number of players here, and all of them become abnormal, namely serum calcium and phosphorus levels, vitamin D levels, parathyroid hormone, and a relatively novel protein that's been discovered called FGF, or fibroblast growth factor 23. Why do we worry about these things? None of these will acutely cause problems most of the time, but at the same time, if we don't manage this well, patients can develop bone pain, they're at increased risk of fractures, but more worrisome is the development of arterial calcification and vascular disease. This can result in increased risk of cardiovascular events, increased risk of death, and there's also an increased risk of something called calciphylaxis. Fortunately, I didn't put any gross pictures in my slides, but it's a horrible, debilitating condition of the skin of skin calcification that can be very painful, very debilitating, and often fatal if we don't do a good job managing all these numbers. So this is kind of a complicated slide, but the mechanism basically goes like this. As our kidney disease gets worse, and we progress towards dialysis, we tend to have a buildup of phosphorus. Our kidneys are not as effective at getting rid of it, and we have trouble maintaining phosphorus homeostasis. That, at the same time, phosphorus, if you have too much of it, can bind to calcium and decrease the levels of calcium in the blood. The elevated phosphorus can lead to increased synthesis of parathyroid hormone, which you've probably have heard of. PTH is a phosphaturic hormone, and so it can increase the dumping of phosphorus out into through the tubules into the kidney. At the same time, phosphorus can increase the synthesis of FGF23, which is synthesized by bones, and it actually helps. It also is a phosphaturic hormone. So both of these help get rid of phosphorus. At the same time, when your calcium levels becomes lower, that can lead to increased synthesis of PTH as well to try to get the calcium back up. Kidneys, at the same time, are responsible for making an enzyme called alpha-1 hydroxylase. Have I lost you all yet? Which activates vitamin D. And so in patients who have kidney disease, levels of 125-OH vitamin D are low. So that can also lead to decreased calcium absorption, which can then lead to increased PTH. So as you can see, everything interacts with everything. And here's another little cartoon that hopefully can explain it a little bit. If you have increases in phosphorus, you're stimulating your FGF23 and your parathyroid hormone, and that ends up leading to increased dumping of phosphorus in the urine and a decrease in your alpha-1 hydroxylase level. So then you end up with less vitamin D, less calcium absorption, and increased parathyroid hormone. Increased levels of parathyroid hormone and FGF23 have been associated with increased mortality. And so it's It's dependent on us to try to, if we're going to focus on one thing, it's really normalizing phosphorus levels. The treatment can be really, really difficult. One of my attendings compared it to like playing a game of whack-a-mole, because as a lot of the medicines that we use will make one of the numbers better, but two of them worse, or they might make two better and one worse. There's nothing out there that makes every single number better. And so oftentimes, or it's like a Rubik's Cube. The analogy I have is like if you want to finish the green side and get every single, all nine greens together. So when you work on it, you get everything set up and all, you have the nine green blocks and it's beautiful looking, but then every other side is a mess. And so what strategies do we take to try to get this under control? So there's the first thing that every patient should do is just eat a low phosphorus diet. And for a lot of patients, this stinks. Phosphorus is in a lot of foods that we like. It's in dairy products. It's in milk, cheese, ice cream. It's in a lot of processed foods, fast foods. Who doesn't love ice cream and fast food, right? So for that reason, it can be really hard to get our patients to eat a low phosphorus diet. Phosphorus, unfortunately, is not too greatly cleared by dialysis. And so we have to rely on our patients or these medications to try to get things under control. The first type of medicine that we'll use is a phosphorus binder. And basically, you take it when you're eating, and they'll bind the phosphorus that you eat, so hopefully you don't absorb it into your bloodstream. And you'll lose the phosphorus in the GI tract, and it won't be able to get into your bloodstream and make your phosphorus go up. There's two types of phosphorus binders. The initial ones that came out were calcium-based binders. This is as simple as taking Tums. Tums is calcium carbonate. If you take that when you eat, you can actually, for very cheaply, you can bind phosphorus. This will increase. However, the worry with these binders is that you're calcium loading patients and potentially increasing that calcium phosphate product, which can cause a lot of problems. Hopefully phosphorus goes down. Maybe you'll get a subtle improvement in the parathyroid hormone since the phosphorus level is a little lower. Non-calcium based phosphate binders, that includes sevalamer, Renvela, Fosrenol, in the old days, aluminum based binders, which aren't really used anymore. And so while these won't raise your calcium level, phosphorus levels will decrease. There's been some evidence that the non-calcium-based binders might be a little better for the reasons I suggested, but both binders continue to be used pretty regularly. If this doesn't work at controlling parathyroid hormone levels, then we can use activated vitamin D supplements. This includes calcitriol, Zemplar, Hectorol, pretty much any of those things. And again, by giving activated vitamin D, if you go back to one of my complicated slides from before, it will show that by activating vitamin D, you're decreasing parathyroid hormone. But remember, what does activated vitamin D do? It goes to your GI tract and says, all right, let's absorb all the calcium and phosphorus that we can. And so, in essence, by giving this, you're calcium loading patients and your phosphorus loading patients. So this can be really tricky to give if a patient has a phosphorus that is too high. So then, in the last several years, a drug called cinacalcet or Sensipar has come along. Cinacalcet is it basically increases the sensitivity of what's called the calcium sensing receptor. And by doing that, it can trick your parathyroid glands into thinking that if your calcium is 9, it might think that your calcium is 11. And then by doing that, it will help shut off parathyroid hormone. And then in turn, calcium and phosphorus levels can decrease. The tricky thing is that it's really hard to give cinacalcet in patients who are hypocalcemic. And so, again, the saga continues. Does this make even a semblance of sense? All right, thank you. So in summary, dialysis patients suffer from a large number of hemodynamic, chemical, hematologic, musculoskeletal abnormalities. We're working feverishly with all of our patients to optimize this prescription to help achieve equilibrium and resolve many of these issues. So thank you very much. If you don't know me, I work with Dr. Lazar and the other Dr. Lazar and Dr. Panos. One of us is always around to help out, answer questions. Here's my contact information, and here's a cute picture of my kids. So thank you very much. Yes? It's very difficult. A number of patients, you know, obviously patients don't, you know, timing of dialysis is one thing. Patients, you know, want their time as low as possible. Some patients come late. We don't know if patients are taking their binders. They're, you know, obviously we can keep recommending an increased dose, but if the phosphorus level stays at 8, we have no idea what's going down the hatch. You're absolutely right. Plus, the binders have to be taken every time someone eats. So if someone's out for lunch, they might not have their pills on them. They're big bulky pills, which in some of our older patients may be difficult to swallow. So there's definitely a number of patients have intolerances to Sensipar. There's a lot of GI intolerance to that. So the patients don't want to take it. So it's absolutely a huge challenge. Let's see, sir. That's a great question. So that's always a last resort for secondary hyperparathyroidism. Usually if you're trying all this stuff and the parathyroid hormone still remains elevated, or if patients kind of develop a subsequent, they can hyperparathyroid, persistently elevated with elevated calcium, a lot of patients can progress to that. We have one patient who, doesn't want to take Sensipar. His PTH is actually 3,000. That's we want our PTHs generally like less than 9 times above the upper limit of normal, which is like 500, and his is really high. Doesn't want to take Sensipar. He's on the maximum amount of activated vitamin D that we can give him. He's someone that will qualify for a parathyroidectomy. And interestingly, for the parathyroidectomies, remember with hypercalcemia, you'll get a parathyroid adenoma, which can just easily be popped out. For dialysis-related hyperparathyroidism, often all 4 glands are hypertrophied. And so surgeons will usually take out 3 to 3.5 and actually implant the remaining gland in someone's forearm, and they can actually bank the parathyroid tissue that was removed in the event that too much is removed and the levels go down. They can actually either take more out or put more in based on how the levels do. Coumadin is still the gold standard. There's a whole controversy about whether dialysis patients with AFib should be anticoagulated, for prevention of stroke and non-valvular AFib. But Eliquis has been approved, and a couple of our patients are on it. It's certainly easier for patients. I think it's a combination of patients are anemic. They're prone to. We're sticking large bore needles, two needles in an access 3 times a week. Uremic platelets, all those things can potentially play a role. So there's a lot of mixed data on it, and it's a big controversy in our community. Thank you.